Chapter 51. Best to fill the void by the constant exercise of his own gift in that direction, and to Odo at least his talk seemed as good as it was copious. Misfortune had given a finer savor to the Marquis's philosophy, and there was a kind of heroic grace in his undisturbed cultivation of the amenities. While the Marquis was struggling to preserve the conversational art, and Elfieri planning the savage revenge of the Misagallo, the course of affairs in France had gained a wilder impetus. The abolition of the nobility, the flight and capture of the king, his enforced declaration of war against Austria, the massacres of Avignon, the sack of the Tuileries, such events seemed incredible enough till the next had crowded them out of mind. The new year rose in blood, and mounted to a bloodier noon. All the old defenses were falling. Religion, monarchy, law, were sucked down into the whirlpool of liberated passions. Across that sanguinary scene passed, like a mocking ghost, the philosopher's vision of the perfectibility of man. Man was free at last, freer than his would-be liberators had ever dreamed of making him, and he used his freedom like a beast. For the multitude had risen, that multitude which no man could number, which even the demagogues who ranted in its name had never seriously reckoned with, that dim, groveling, indistinguishable mass on which the whole social structure rested. It was as though the very soil moved, rising in mountains or yawning in chasms about the feet of those who had so long securely battened on it. The earth shook, the sun and moon were darkened, and the people, the terrible unknown people, had put in the sickle to the harvest. Italy roused herself at last. The emissaries of the New France were swarming across the Alps, pervading the peninsula as the Jesuits had once pervaded Europe, and in the mind of a young general of the Republican army, visions of Italian conquest were already forming. In Pianura the revolutionary agents found a strong Republican party headed by Gamba and his friends, and a government weakened by debt and dissensions. The air was thick with intrigue. The little army could no longer be counted on, and a prolonged bread riot had driven Tresker out of the ministry, and compelled the Duke to appoint Andrianni in his place. Behind Andrianni stood Gamba and the radicals. There could be no doubt which way the fortunes of the duchy tended. The dukes would be protectors. Austria and the Holy See were too busy organizing the hasty coalition of the powers to come to his aid, had he cared to call on them. But to do so would have been but another way of annihilation. To preserve the individuality of his state, or to merge it in the vision of a united Italy, seemed to him the only alternatives worth fighting for. The former was a futile dream, the latter seemed for a brief moment possible. Piedmont, ever loyal to the monarchical principle, was calling on her sister states to arm themselves against the French invasion. But the response was reluctant and uncertain. Private ambitions and petty jealousies hampered every attempt at union. Austria, the Bourbons and the Holy See held the Italian principalities in a network of conflicting interests and obligations that rendered free action impossible. Sadly, Victor Amadis armed himself alone against the enemy. Under such conditions, Odo could do little to direct the course of events. They had passed into more powerful hands than his. But he could at least declare himself for or against the mighty impulse which was behind them. The ideas he had striven for had triumphed at last, and his surest hold on authority was to share openly in their triumph. A profound horror dragged him back. The new principles were not those for which he had striven. The goddess of the new worship was but a bloody Maenad who had borrowed the attributes of freedom. He could not bow the knee in such a charnel house. Tranquilly, resolutely, he took up the policy of repression. He knew the attempt was foredoomed to failure, but that made no difference now. He was simply acting out the inevitable. The last act came with unexpected suddenness. The Duke woke one morning to find the citadel in the possession of the people. The impregnable stronghold of Braxiafort was in the hands of the serfs whose fathers had toiled to build it, and the last descendant of Braxiafort was virtually a prisoner in his palace. The revolution took place quietly, without violence or bloodshed. Andrea and I waited on the Duke, and a cabinet council was summoned. The ministers affected to have yielded reluctantly to popular pressure. All they asked was a constitution and the assurance that no resistance would be offered to the French. The Duke requested a few hours for deliberation. Left alone, he summoned the Duchess's chamberlain. The ducal pair no longer met save on occasions of state. They had not exchanged a word since the death of Fulvia Vivaldi. Odo sent word to Her Highness that he could no longer answer for her security while she remained in the duchy, and that he begged her to leave immediately for Vienna. She replied that she was obliged for his warning, but that while he remained in Pianura her place was at his side. It was the answer he had expected. He had never doubted her courage, but it was essential to his course that she should leave the duchy without delay, and after a moment's reflection he wrote a letter in which he informed her that he must insist on her obedience. No answer was returned, but he learned that as he had turned white, and tearing the letter in shreds had called for her traveling carriage within the hour. He sent to inquire when he might take leave of her, but she excused herself on the plea of indisposition, and before nightfall he heard the departing rattle of her wheels. He immediately summoned Andrea and I, and announced his unconditional refusal of the terms proposed to him. He would not give a constitution or promise allegiance to the French. The minister withdrew, and Odo was left alone. He had dismissed his gentleman, and as he sat in his closet a sense of death-like isolation came over him. Never had the palace seemed so silent or so vast. He had not a friend to turn to. De Crucis was in Germany, and Tresker, it was reported, had privately attended the Duchess in her flight. The waves of destiny seemed closing over Odo, and the circumstances of his past rose, poignant and vivid, before his drowning sight. And suddenly, in that moment of failure and abandonment, it seemed to him again that life was worth the living. His indifference fell from him like a garment. The old passion of action awoke, and he felt a new warmth in his breast. After all, the struggle was not yet over. Though Piedmont had called in vain on the Italian states, an Italian sword might still be drawn in her service. If his people would not follow him against France, he could still march against her alone. Old memories hummed in him at the thought. He recalled how his Piedmontese ancestors had gone forth against the same foe, and the stout Donna's blood began to bubble in his veins. A knock roused him, and Gamba entered by the private way. His appearance was not unexpected to Odo, and served only to reinforce his newfound energy. He felt that the issue was at hand. As he expected, Gamba had been sent to put before him more forcibly and unceremoniously the veiled threat of the ministers. But the hunchback had come also, to plead with his master in his own name, and in the name of the ideas for which they had once labored together. He could not believe that the Duke's reaction was more than momentary. He could not calculate the strength of the old associations which, now that the tide had set the other way, were dragging Odo back to the beliefs and traditions of his caste. The Duke listened in silence, then he said, "Colon, discussion is idle. I have no answer to give, but that which I have already given." He rose from his seat in token of dismissal. The moment was painful to both men. Gamba drew near and fell at the Duke's feet. "Your Highness," he said, "consider what this means. We hold the state in our hands. If you are against us, you are powerless. If you are with us, we can promise you more power than you ever dreamed of possessing." The Duke looked at him with a musing smile. "It is as though you offered me gold in a desert island," he said. "Do not waste such poor bribes on me. I care for no power, but the power to wipe out the work of these last years. Failing that, I want nothing that you or any other man can give." Gamba was silent a moment. He turned aside into the embrasure of the window, and when he spoke again it was in a voice broken with grief. "Your Highness," he said, "if your choice is made, ours is made also. It is a hard choice, but these are fratricidal hours. We have come to the parting of the ways. The Duke made no sign, and Gamba went on with gathering anguish, colon, we would have gone to the world's end with your highness for our leader. With a leader whom you could lead, Odo interposed. He went up to Gamba, and laid a hand on his shoulder. Speak out, man, he said. Say what you were sent to say. Am I a prisoner? The hunchback burst into tears. Odo, with his arms crossed, stood leaning against the window. The other's anguish seemed to deepen his detachment. Your Highness, Gamba stammered. The Duke made an impatient gesture. See, come, make an end, he said. Gamba fell back with a profound bow. We do not ask the surrender of your Highness's person, he said. Not even that? Odo returned with a faint sneer. Gamba flushed to the temples, but the retort died on his lips. Your Highness, he said, scarce above a whisper, the gates are guarded, but the word for tonight is humilitas. Apostrophe he knelt and kissed Odo's hand. Then he rose and passed out of the room. Before dawn the Duke left the palace. The high emotions of the night had ebbed. He saw himself now, in the ironic light of morning, as a fugitive too harmless to be worth pursuing. His enemies had let him keep his sword, because they had no cause to fear it. Alone he passed through the gardens of the palace, and out into the desert darkness of the streets. Skirting the wall of the Benedictine convent where Fulvia had lodged, he gained a street leading to the marketplace. In the pallor of the waning night the ancient monuments of his race stood up mournful and deserted as a line of tombs. The city seemed a graveyard and he the ineffectual ghost of its dead past. He reached the gates and gave the watchword. The gates were guarded, as he had been advised. But the captain of the watch let him pass without show of hesitation or curiosity. Though he made no effort at disguise he went forth unrecognized, and the city closed her doors on him as carelessly as on any passing wanderer. Beyond the gates a lad from the Dussel stables waited with a horse. Odo sprang into the saddle and rode on toward Pontesordo. The darkness was growing thinner, and the meager details of the landscape, with its huddled farmhouses and mulberry orchards, began to define themselves as he advanced. To his left the field stretched, gray and sodden. Ahead, on his right, hung the dark woods of the Dussel Chase. Presently a bend of the road brought him within sight of the keep of Pontesordo. His way led past it, toward Valseca, but some obscure instinct laid a detaining hand on him, and at the crossroads he bent to the right, and rode across the marshland to the old manor house. The farmyard lay hushed and deserted. The peasants who lived there would soon be afoot, but for the moment Odo had the place to himself. He tethered his horse to a gate post, and walked across the rough cobblestones to the chapel. Its floor was still heaped with farm tools and dried vegetables, and in the dimness a heavier veil of dust seemed to obscure the painted walls. Odo advanced, picking his way among broken plowshares and stacks of maize, till he stood near the old marble altar, with its sea gods and acanthus volutes. The place laid its tranquilizing hush on him, and he knelt on the step beneath the altar. Something stirred in him as he knelt there, a prayer, yet not a prayer, a reaching out, obscure and inarticulate, toward all that had survived of his early hopes and faiths, a loosening of old founts of pity, a longing to be somehow, somewhere reunited to his old belief in life. How long he knelt he knew not, but when he looked up the chapel was full of a pale light, and in the first shaft of the sunrise the face of Saint Francis shone out on him. He went forth into the daybreak and rode away toward Piedmont. End of Project Gutenberg's text, The Valley of Decision, by Edith Wharton. VLDC and by Gutenberg Edition.